Glad you could join us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time for our roundtable discussion about Wisconsin wildlife and nature with our outdoor communicators. Our three regulars, Pat Durkin with us, a freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. He's in Idaho right now. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Dean Boritz, who's in Montana, is with us. He's the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Dean, thank you for joining in.
Yeah, no problem, Larry. Happy to be here.
And with me in the studio, Tim Isley, a freelance outdoor writer and private landowner in Crawford County. And Tim, always great to see you. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Larry. Very happy to be here locally.
And with us as well by phone, Dan Small, host of another Deer Hunt Wisconsin television special. He's been with us for a few minutes to start the show. He's a contributing editor for Wisconsin Outdoor News as well. Dan, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Well, good to be back, Larry. Thank you. And I'm actually in Wheaton, Illinois, so this is a multi-state conversation. Yeah, I'm heading home today. I've been out of town on vacation after getting the deer show done.
Oh, well, I tell you what, I want to talk to you about that show, but I want to just invite our listeners, as you listen in, I hope you'll share your own thoughts on wildlife conservation, hunting in the state. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dan, for PBS Milwaukee, you have co-produced your 34th annual TV special. This one, Deer Hunt Wisconsin 2024. Give us a preview of the hour before it airs this week and next.
Yes, it's going to air on multiple stations, and we can do the schedule here in a little bit. It's actually, there are two versions of the show. The commercial version is an hour long with obviously commercial breaks, and the PBS version is a half hour long. And the difference is there will be hunting segments in both versions, but no product-related segments in the public version, I guess is the easiest way to put it. So we will be talking to successful hunters, most of them from last year, although one is a hunter who actually killed the very first deer taken in Wisconsin legally, as far as we know, with an air-powered rifle. And that's in the commercial version of the show. We talked to some youth hunters. We went on two learn-to-hunt events with some young hunters and some adults who were first-timers. And what else did we do? Of course, we look at the new rules, and there aren't too many changes this year. The big one in my mind is the air gun being legal now, and I'm actually going to be hunting with an air gun this year, and I think Dean is too, or at least he's suggested he might be. And we feature some photos that we've got from viewers, and actually we got a lot of them from readers of Outdoor News because they submit photos to the paper, and we use some of those too. So what we tried to do is give people an idea of what to expect this season with a forecast, a very rudimentary forecast, not detailed, not in a lot of detail, and a look at new rules, a look at some habitat management, and then talking to successful hunters, because I think that's the most exciting part, is hearing how other hunters have been successful or how they got into hunting. And in particular, we have a young woman who is a hunter education instructor. She's confined to a wheelchair, but confined is probably an inappropriate word. She is a very active hunter and, as I mentioned, a hunter education instructor as well. And we've got her on the show this year, too. So that's kind of a quick summary, and we reload rifle cartridges with the folks at MEC, Mayville Engineering. And I think that pretty much is it. Oh, and we look at the deer donation program, because that's something that has been just a remarkable feature of our hunting opportunities. I think Wisconsin hunters have donated 100,000 deer, give or take a few, and that's 4 million pounds of venison, and that's to food pantries. So we actually follow a young friend of mine who shot a deer and donated it, and, you know, we went through the whole process of how that happened. So that's a quick summary of what's going on in this issue.
I got a preview of the show, and it's very well, as always, very well done. It really was inspiring to me to hear and watch the young gal that you just spoke about, who's in her wheelchair. Very remarkable, very well-spoken young woman.
Yes, Lindsay Minch is her name. She's from Campbellsport, and she openly will admit that hunting turned her life around. She found a focus and a purpose, and she is a real gung-ho hunter ed instructor, and just a great person to interview and to get to know. Actually, I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, and that statewide organization, Kids and Mentors Outdoors, or CAMO for short, that is, maybe talk about that group's mission.
Well, the acronym CAMO, Kids and Mentors Outdoors, it was founded a couple decades ago, I think, by Mark Walters. He's an outdoor communicator, a full-time freelance syndicated columnist who is out there doing something every week of the year, and he writes about it for, I think, 50 or 60 newspapers across the state. And a number of years ago, he was concerned, as all of us have been, and I know, because I've had these conversations with your other guests, those of us who've been in the hunting and fishing field for a long, long time know that the number of hunters and anglers is decreasing. And he was not seeing a lot of young people coming up, and he said, I can do something about this. And so he formed this organization with some friends, and they have a half a dozen chapters throughout the state. And they do one-on-one hunts, and they do an annual hunt they call the Joe Hunt, named for a former DNR employee who was very influential and instrumental in getting this going, Joe Stecker-Krashansky. And unfortunately, Joe died a few years ago of a heart attack, and they named the hunt after him. And this last year, and we had our videographer, Dave Roll, there, they actually killed 22 deer. I think there were 23 or 24 kids, and they killed 22 deer. They're hunting in the McKenzie area in Portage County.
Yeah, it was a really amazing story there, and I really liked it. The show, talk about when the show is set to air.
Well, it's a little complicated, but the commercial version will air on the FanDuel Sports Network, and that's formerly Bally and formerly Fox. So if you remember the old Fox Sports Network, that's the network. Yep. And it airs tonight after the Bucks game on the Wisconsin Network and after the Timberwolves game on the North Network. So sometime between 10 and midnight, you can catch the full commercial version of the show tonight. And then there are repeats, a couple on the weekend, and I think one more next week. And then tomorrow night, Thursday the 14th, Milwaukee PBS, which used to be the host station, the home station for the show, will air the half-hour version starting at 9 p.m. in the outdoor Wisconsin time slot. And then Saturday, Milwaukee airs it again at 9 a.m. and PBS Wisconsin airs it for the first time at 10:30 a.m. And then Sunday, PBS Wisconsin airs it again at 3 p.m. And then the following Friday, PBS airs it at 3 p.m. And I think that's it. And then it will be on our YouTube channel. When I get home tonight, I need to post the segments on the Deer Hunt Wisconsin TV YouTube channel so people can view them at any time. And then also the Wisconsin Community Media Network, it's a bunch of local cable stations. They will air the show various times in the next couple of weeks leading up to a deer season. And actually, many of them air it, you know, right through deer season and into December as well.
Yeah. Do you have a schedule printed up somewhere online where people could just go to it and take a look?
I just posted it on my Facebook page, which is Dan Small Outdoors. So if you go there, you can see that entire schedule that I just rattled off.
Oh, okay. So Dan Small Outdoors, right?
Yep.
There's a lot in that show every year, and you always do a wonderful job, Dan. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about it. Appreciate it very much.
Well, you bet. Thank you, Larry, and I appreciate the time, and I hope people have a chance to enjoy it. And I will respond to any messages I get on the Facebook page. Maybe not right away, but I'll get back to you. So,
okay. Dan Small, our guest, host, producer of the public television show Outdoor Wisconsin, Outdoor Radio with Dan Small, and a contributing editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Great to have him with us for a few minutes to talk about this year's version, Deer Hunt Wisconsin 2024. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at Wisconsin Outdoors today with our three guests, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, and Tim Isley, also a freelance outdoor writer, private landowner in Crawford County, and a founding member of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. And, of course, Pat Durkin is the president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Questions for him? For them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Otto and Odana. Odana has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Otto.
Good morning. Glad to be talking with all you guys. You guys all write very well, and thanks for all the work that you do, and Larry for hosting the show. I'm calling about, we're at the 20-year anniversary of the Chai Vang massacre, and I was calling to maybe take the temperature with you guys on the social fabric of Wisconsin's hunting community. You know, that he was obviously a disturbed psychopath that killed those hunters, but he was, I think, dressed down and triggered in those woods 20 years ago. Maybe talk a little bit about where you see the Wisconsin hunting community and all its different members now in 2024.
So kind of the social fabric of hunting community and maybe how it has changed. Well, let's see. Let's turn to Dean Bortz first. Dean?
The circles that I move around in, I have never seen anything like that. I don't really think the social fabric has changed. That was such an outlier of an incident. I see a lot of different groups. I hunt with a lot of different people. I've never been in a situation where things have gotten hot. Most people, if there's a question about anything, they'll discuss it. you know, and if it warms up a little bit, somebody just, you know, they just walk away and call law enforcement. You know, our wardens have dealt with hunter harassment issues over the years. We see that in game warden field reports once in a while, but it is nothing that's ever risen to the level that our caller has just, you know, described or reminded us about.
Yeah. I think, well, Pat, let's hear from you. Pat?
Yeah, I agree with Dean. The thing I guess I'd keep in mind is that even at the time, that was a real odd outlier that we had never seen in Wisconsin history. And but I guess that it reminds all of us that when people are out in the woods and getting a confrontation and everyone's carrying a firearm, in that case, a lot of the victims were not carrying firearms, but they're still was a firearm, you know, with at least one of those members. This isn't a time to confront people aggressively and humiliate them. You don't know what that guy's dealing with in his life. You know, these are total strangers, and they really messed with, you know, one hothead messed with another hothead, and it was just a bad outcome. So I guess that's just my advice, is that if you get yourself in a confrontation, back off quickly. It's just not worth it when the other guy has a firearm with him.
Tim, hear from you.
Thanks, Larry. Yeah, I would say that was such an unusual incident. And, you know, we've had such a good record of with all of the hunter education and hunter training over the years and how they have tried to instill hunting ethics in people and getting people to understand the need for safety out hunting, that this was just very unusual. And, you know, there's so many hunters that I meet and so many groups. There's one group of fellows that we come in contact with every year. These are duck hunters, not necessarily deer hunters, but good ethical people and getting along with other people. And I just think that was just an unusual instance. Maybe it was some of the underlying racial concerns that basically there's, I think, more concern now about racial justice. And that just was very unusual. But I give a lot of credit to people who obey by the law and accept other people.
I think that the deer hunt itself, has changed over time, and that's, I think, how people hunt is much different than it was kind of back in the day. And I know Pat had some kind of interesting thoughts about how hunting has changed over the years. Some of them kind of we'd look at it now and think, gosh, that's kind of funny the way it happened. But Pat, you reminded me about the old deer hunter roundups.
Yeah, I was pretty much unaware of deer hunter roundups on local radio stations up north until I started hunting the UP back in the late 80s. And those of us old enough to remember that era, you know, this is before cell phones, this is before the internet and quick communications. And my friend and I used to sit in our camper trailer at night after hunting and listen to the local radio stations to get all the news from local deer camps and hear women, wives leaving messages for their husbands like 40 miles away to get them a quick message through the radio stations. And also the deer hunter roundups, they'd take in reports from deer camps and then read over the air the names of the hunters and who shot what. And it was a kind of a fun way to interact with people back in this era when local radio stations were independently owned and they had staffs and they had local hosts that everyone in the area kind of knew those folks. And I just remember some fun moments, like there's cases where like let's say a local school teacher would be hunting deer up north. And every deer season, someone would phone in and say, oh, Bill Green at whatever camp it was, he shot an 85-pound spike. and every year, they'd do that to this guy. And he never did figure out who was phoning, who was calling in this information on him. And it was just those kind of fun things. And other guys would call in with kind of joking with their friends about how a certain guy would always kill a buck on this one road that went right past, you know, the guy's deer camp. So in my case, it would have been like, I used to always hunt a lot with Tom Heberlein on the Conley Road up in Ashland County. And I can just see how Heberlein would stew if somebody was always killing a buck just a half mile from his cabin. And so it was kind of a, I miss that kind of stuff. You know, they might still have round deer on the round up north that I just haven't heard in recent years, but it was a fun era.
It was. I can remember going to, there was a, this was in the north, there was a bar, and they had an outdoors, they had a telephone. You know, the typical little box type of phone, and there'd be, you'd go over there to call home, and there'd be a lineup of guys typically standing in line waiting to call home.
Yeah, I remember in the UP, I'd go down to the local bar the night before gun season, because I usually showed up early to bow hunt a couple days. And I remember standing in one of those lines and talking to a guy, and the guy says to me, yeah, tomorrow the gun season starts. We finally get it back from those bow hunters. And not realizing that was... I just shot a deer that like 2 days before with a bow and arrow. So I thought it was funny that he just kind of assumed I was one of him, you know, and that I didn't like bow hunters. And actually, I am a bow hunter.
Well, we've got CWD, chronic wasting diseases. We're in, what, 44 of our 72 counties right now that it's confirmed, probably is right. In others as well. Has CWD impacted the number of people who deer hunt today, do you think?
It's really hard to put a number in that, Larry, because, you know, we are in decline anyway because of the this way society has changed. And this is one of those interesting discussions that we've been trying to figure out for 20 years now, is how is CWD actually affecting the deer hunting population? And I can't say that I've seen anything that really draws a good, strong connection between people dropping out of the hunt because of CWD. I just know in my case, I keep hunting my cousin's farm in Richland County, even though my daughter and I, who hunt, she also hunts there, four out of the past five deer she and I have shot have tested positive. And it does change how you look. It changes how I look at it. But I still enjoy deer hunting so much that I always go back there. I hope that the next deer I shoot won't test positive. But it does kind of make you think a lot about every time you see a deer now. We're not good at figuring out by looking at them which ones are sick and which ones aren't. Mm-hmm. So I still say I shoot the first deer I get a good chance at and then hope for the best.
Yeah, I think we were talking about some of the research on this with the CWD deer. It's interesting because the deer don't really, it's not a slow decline, typically.
Correct.
If I'm not mistaken. And so it's just like they suddenly get sick. They look perfectly healthy, and then they suddenly get sick. And, you know, a week or so later, or a week or two later, they've gone. But they just drop like a rock, I think.
Yeah, their physical decline, where it becomes noticeable to us, it's only like, I think, a relatively short time, maybe a month and a half, and they go downhill real fast at the end. But they can carry that disease, you know, for like 2 years before it becomes noticeable, to our eye. You know, they're probably in decline in ways we can't see with our experience, you know, as far as our eyes and whatever we hear and see. But they're definitely sick, and it's not getting any better as the herd goes.
Yeah. Well, and I'm assuming it's advantageous to remove infected deer.
Yeah, I my hunting has changed, Larry. I used to be one of these guys who'd hold out for an older buck and shoot antlerless deer and be happy with that. But these days on the farm anyway, I shoot whatever I see now, as far as once if it's just fawns, I usually let them go. But if I see a yearling buck now, I shoot it because I know they're the ones that are most likely to be carrying the disease and spreading the disease. So if I see an adult doe, I shoot right away. So it's really changed how I go about my hunting.
Dean, a comment and thoughts from you.
I don't hunt in the CWD area. I'm hunting generally up in Ashland, Iron, Bayfield, Price counties, Oneida, Vilas too. And so it really hasn't changed how I hunt yet. But if I ended up in a area, you know, CWD county, like Pat does down in Richland, I would probably be doing the same thing. In that situation, there's no sense in letting anything walk by. You need to get the numbers down, get deer tested. But, it hasn't changed anything where I'm hunting for myself or the group that I hunt with. And as far as numbers of whether CWD has affected hunter numbers, I'd have to agree with Pat. There's probably really no way to tell. We know it has. I mean, I've talked to readers who have told me that they're no longer hunting at all or have moved away from a CWD area. But as far as getting a pulse on that, I don't know how we would do that.
Yeah. Tim, you wanted to?
Yes, I agree. I think, you know, in Pat and in Dean, you've got a couple of very avid longtime deer hunters.
Yeah.
I think that for some hunters who are not that avid, who were deer hunters, maybe it was, there's always a lot that socialization, your camp and the people you're with, that's always very important. But I think for those hunters who are not that avid longtime hunters, I think it raises questions, and I think some of the people have dropped out. I mean, I don't have numbers to prove it that was specifically due to CWD, but there's a lot of concern right now, and especially as CWD has grown and has expanded. I mean, the other thing, too, is that we're finding some of the meat lockers are going out of business, and so it's harder for some of the people who don't butcher their own meat to find a place to actually take their deer and then have it tested there, or get somebody to come in and take those nodes out. I would encourage everybody to get their deer tested, yeah.
I want to turn our attention to the Natural Resources Board for a minute. And Tim, I know you keep an eye on the board, I think all three of you do. But
yes.
The board sets policy for the DNR, and the Natural Resources Board has a new member, Rachel Barisa.
Right. She's representing one of the members of the Natural Resources Board has to have a background in farming or agriculture. And so she has that background. She's replacing a gentleman from the Viroqua area who was a farmer and suddenly resigned, and Paul Burr. And I've tried to reach him. I don't have a response. We don't have any knowledge of why he resigned. But there's been a lot of upheaval on the board because in the past the governor had appointed new people, and then the Senate refused to confirm them. And so there's been a lot of turmoil on the board. And finally, for a while, they hoped that they had that they had people on the board who had served for a while. They've got different backgrounds in natural resources. It's a whole citizen board. All these people, they're volunteers. And if you look at the time that they spend, it's called what they get is a green sheet at the board meetings. It's a whole packet of information on all of the issues that come up. They spend a tremendous amount of time, and they're all volunteers. And so it's really interesting. So now this new member, she was at her first meeting in October. I haven't had a chance to meet her yet, but she has an agricultural background. But one of the interesting things is that the legislature has, the Senate, has refused to confirm some of these past members. And so it's a constant turnover. And we're hoping to get people on the board who could stay for a while and not have that constant turnover. And it's going to be very interesting because of the recent elections. There's changes in the legislature. The Democrats have picked up some seats in there. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what effect that will have. just like we don't have a permanent DNR secretary. And it's going to be interesting to see now with the changes in the legislature, if the governor is finally willing to come out with a recommendation for a DNR secretary and somebody who can get confirmed. So it's interesting, though, to see the changes there. But these people are all, other than the DNR secretary, these people are volunteers, and they spend an awful lot of time on the issues, and I think they have to be given an awful lot of credit.
To give everybody an idea, maybe we can talk about what you think the issues are that the NRB will tackle this year and next.
Well, there's always deer. Deer is always on the agenda. But then there's a lot of things, of course, with clean water, clean air, with PFOS and PFAS. And, of course, they've tried to – there's a fund there that there's been money which has been allocated for use, but the legislature has not allowed to release that. Another thing which is really interesting is stewardship. The stewardship program will be ending, I believe, in another year. And the governor has, or the DNR has requested in the new budget for 2025-2026 to renew stewardship. And it's interesting because in the past, there were a lot of problems with land that was being purchased with stewardship, and the Joint Finance Committee would not approve that, and they either went against it or they had what they call a passive rejection. But this last summer in July, the Supreme Court ruled basically that because the legislature had approved the money for stewardship, that this Joint Finance Committee could not veto some of those things that where they wanted to buy the land. So this is going to be really interesting to see whether or not the stewardship law is going to be renewed, and whether the legislature then is going to put the money in there or whether they're going to restrict some of the money. So stewardship is one of the things that probably will be coming up for the board too.
Yeah. And this whole business of the DNR secretary, maybe I turn to Pat and Dean too for some comments. We haven't had a DNR secretary for more than a year now, and so the DNR has been operating without a leader. What are the concerns about that in your minds? Pat, start with you.
A lot of things come to mind, Larry. I guess we kind of talked about this the last time we got together, but I'll try not to repeat all my points from that time. But I guess one thing that I think this is a real immediate concern that we've been, you know, kind of avoiding for many years now is the lack of funding the DNR is taking in. We're seeing some tremendous shortfalls now in funding, and a lot of it's because we have not raised our license fees for over 20 years now, or about 20 years, 19 years, I guess, to be exact. And you'd think when you have a DNR secretary who speaks for the agency, it can go out and talk to organizations and talk to other politicians about the situation. Yeah, you know, it's a way of showing leadership and setting an agenda and then taking the agenda out to the public and trying to get them to buy into it. And you don't have that one person carrying that responsibility and taking it out to the public. You know, it's just opportunities lost now where we have a year without a person in charge of that ship.
Yeah. Dean, a comment from you?
Well, I just got a text from a friend of mine who said he thinks that I ought to throw my hat in a ring for DNR secretary, and I know he's kidding. But then if that's the case, I'd just nominate Pat or Tim then. But oh, I did have a thought on that, but it jumped out of my brain when I saw Gilly's text come in. Let's see. What was my thought going to be on the DNR secretary deal? Crap. But instead of trying to recapture that, because it'll jump back in there eventually. You know, we always have been, well, the last couple of times we've talked about this, come up with different recommendations that the governor could appoint, or folks that the governor could appoint. And I'm going to add two new ones besides Pat and Tim. I think Christine Thomas, I know she's probably listening, and I'm in Montana, but I'm pretty sure I can see her hand raising. Oh, no, wait, it's waving. She's waving. No, she's waving it off. Okay, no. Okay. I think she would be a great DNR secretary, but I know that she has plenty of other irons in the fire. And Jeff Nania, I've known Jeff for a while, and I don't know why his name never came up in my mind as a possible DNR secretary. But I don't know if anybody Jeff's a low-key individual, with the exception that he's now written 4 mystery novels set in northern Wisconsin. But this guy has quite a breadth of experience in a lot of different areas. Very commonsensical, and I would nominate him for DNR secretary if I were governor.
Yeah. I've interviewed him about his novels more than once on the show.
Well, then you know him. Yeah, he'd make a good DNR secretary.
Well, as long as we're throwing out names, anybody else got a name? Pat, you got one?
No, I really don't. I just know I always start with this premise, Larry, that I'm a Wisconsin chauvinist, and I really just know from covering the outdoors in the state for 40 years now, we have some tremendous people in this field. Even if it's a retired person who just wants to fill the void for a year or two till they can get their act together in the legislature, I have no doubt that the governor has some people in mind, and for some reason it just hasn't pushed one of them into this spot. I struggle to believe that the governor has not found someone willing to step forward and do this job for the time being.
Yeah. Tim?
Yes, there's many, many good people, and I think often it's really good when you get people from within the agency. I know one of the names I've heard in the past and would be a really good one used to be the director of forestry, Paul DeLong, somebody who was a really leader. Randy Stark, who used to be the chief warden, really good. In the past, I think Dean had mentioned a couple of names. Usually the governor will look for somebody who's been in politics because you're at state government. And I think Dean had mentioned Dale Schultz in the past, who really is a good natural resources background. He tends to be a Republican. Somebody else who tends to be a Democrat could be Kathleen Falk. I mean, she's had a lot of experience. And an avid hunter and a lot of experience in politics and in natural resources. So these are all good people, and the governor needs to find somebody and get somebody in that seat, and we need a permanent secretary at the DNR. They are the cheerleaders of that agency. They've got to promote that agency, and they've got to push for it. And it's really important to have a secretary in that job.
Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley, our guests today, are outdoor communicators. Always great to have. They come by about every, 3 or 4 months, they'll come by and talk about these issues. And I hope you'll join in with your thoughts, questions, or comments. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at Wisconsin Outdoors today with our three guests, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer, private landowner in Crawford County, founding member of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Questions, comments, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Phil in Plymouth, Wisconsin. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to make a point that the next appointment to this position, I would like to see someone with a good scientific background. I think it's super important. I grew up in a state, not in Wisconsin. I've been in Wisconsin for the better part of 30 years. And we had very little control over it. I hear a lot of bad stuff where people talk about the DNR here. I think that the DNR does a wonderful job of monitoring and controlling that end of it. I would just like to see someone in the scientific field be in charge of that. You know, a perfect example is look at the job they've done in Winnebago with the sturgeon. You know, if they'd have let them run wild with that, we wouldn't have any sturgeon in there anymore. So I think it's really important that they monitor it and pay attention to the sciences on it.
Phil, thank you so much for calling. Tim, I know you want to join in on that.
You bet. I certainly agree with Phil 100%. And I think it goes back a lot to the fact that the Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources used to be appointed by the Natural Resources Board. Seven citizens who would take a look at the people's backgrounds and appoint somebody in that position, and basing a lot of it on science in their background. Back when Tommy Thompson was governor, he changed the Department of Natural Resources and brought it into the cabinet. So now the governor appoints the secretary of the DNR. And so often that's why you find the person who is the secretary has got a background in politics. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they've got a background in natural resources. And normally the people we have had have done hunting and fishing. But the problem, I think, is the fact that the governor is appointing the secretary. You know, when you used to be years ago when I would see things put out by different state departments of natural resources in their news releases, they'd always say, you know, something according to the governor. Well, you know automatically that the governor is appointing the head of that agency because they always have to quote the governor in their news releases. You know, rather than quoting the local biologist, the fish manager, the wildlife manager, and or the forester. So the important thing, I think, is who's appointing the secretary. Hopefully the governor will take that into effect and look for somebody with a really good science background. But I think the flaw in the system is not having the Natural Resources Board appoint the secretary.
And Pat, I know you wanted to join in too.
Yeah, I agree with most of what Tim said. The only thing I'd point out is that I don't think you have to have a science degree to appreciate science and respect science. And we have a lot of good people out there in our government and elsewhere that who understand that science is always evolving. It's not a fixed thing. We got to keep doing research. We got to keep moving forward with this, with our understanding of these things. And what we know today won't be the end all. That, you know, 10 years from now, we'll know more. So we have got to have that respect for this, letting the scientific process play out. And then following it as best we can. So, but I don't think you need to be a biologist necessarily to understand that. I think I like to think that, for example, the three of us, Tim, Dean, and me, we don't have scientific degrees, but I think we all have a decent respect for that field and try to keep up with it.
Hey, Larry?
Yeah, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, and the one other thing I'd add is that, you know, when we've all seen it, is prior to 1995, when Tommy Thompson made that change, we had DNR secretaries who were there for extended periods of time. They didn't change every election cycle. So we had, you know, built-in institutional knowledge that went along with that person. As long as they were doing a good job, you know, they could, you know, they could work 20, 25, 30, 35 years as DNR secretary and pull that wagon all the way along and, you know, continue doing good work. And now, every election cycle, if it changes, we have to, you know, when I say we, I'm talking about the DNR staff, has to re-educate, or I shouldn't say re-educate, educate the incoming DNR secretary, get them up to speed. You know, we wouldn't have to do that if we could get back to the original idea of how we would run the DNR.
And Dave in Madison has a comment on this as well. Dave, go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. It seems like there's a common thread with the current DNR challenges, and that's the Republican legislature. Without the ability to confirm the NRB, you know, why would a secretary want to step up into that position? Because they don't know what their board looks like. So it just seems like it's going to be this constant cycle of rejection, and then there's just going to be no consistency because there's no opportunity as long as the legislature is where it's at. that includes stewardship dollars as well. They're holding the purse strings, and until they get their way on the DNR, they're just not going to get anywhere. I would argue the since Scott Walker days, the Republican legislature has been trying to torpedo the DNR, and nothing's going anywhere because of that. But
Dave, thank you very much for calling. Tim, comment?
I would agree with him wholeheartedly. There's been that war between the legislature and the DNR, and especially regarding funding. And funding is one of the most critical things right now because the DNR is running short of funds. And, I mean, this is all about natural resources, clean air, clean water. These are things that everybody should have an interest in, and it doesn't make a difference whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And people ought to have a common interest in this, and it just seems like there's been a war there, and it needs to stop.
Yeah. We have a totally different question from Alan Hillsborough, who wonders how many deer were killed in collisions with motor vehicles on Wisconsin roadways. And I happen to have the numbers. I happen to have the numbers in front of me on that. And there's 15,000 to 20,000 deer-related crashes annually in Wisconsin. In 2023, there were 16,153 deer-related crashes in our state, resulting in 14 deaths and 585 injuries, which I'm sure every person would like to have that down to zero, and yeah. I'm especially sure that every insurance company that insures motorists in Wisconsin would love to have that change as well.
Just shows that really drivers have got to be concerned, not only just on cars coming at them and cars behind them on the traffic, but also keep your eyes open for that deer standing along the edge. And, of course, during the rut, usually that last week of October and first week of November, and maybe now with the warmer weather stretching in a little bit into mid-November, drivers need to be aware.
Yeah. Well, have you ever been involved in a deer car collision?
Unfortunately, I was. I was driving back then. Ironically, I worked for the DNR up at Eau Claire, and I was driving from a meeting back to the back to home in Eau Claire at night, and the first thing I saw was the white nose of a deer right to my left, and it was dark. Had no idea that that animal was there, and it tried to jump over the car, came down and crashed on the windshield and broke the windshield and brought it in. And there was glass all over. And it just that's not a fun experience.
Yeah. Well, let's get the story from Dean and Pat. Dean.
I did hit one deer. It was the night before opening of deer season, probably in the mid 90s, and I was heading to that year. I was hunting near Rosholt in Portage County with a friend of mine, and my brother was already down there. It was that really wet opening weekend, so would that have been 1993? 91 was the blizzard, so probably 93. And I was somewhere east of the Mosinee Airport, and I smoked a doe with my Buick Century that I was driving at the time. Yeah, if anybody wants to have a good ice fishing vehicle, get an old Buick Century. That front wheel drive will get you anywhere. But I had my oldest son with me, and my oldest daughter. And so they, you know, the car was packed with their stuff, my stuff. The trunk was packed. The only place I could put that doe was across the hood, right up against the windshield. And somehow, I can't remember how I fastened her there, but I drove her to the shack, and we already had one deer on the meat pole that night. But that was a little bit of a fracas trying to. Yeah, she wasn't dead when I hit her, and I had to dispatch her somehow. I won't go into details on that, but got a little bit rodeo out there that night, and all the rain. I mean, it's raining like crazy, and it was just wet, and it was just a mess.
A mess. Well, we'll find out from Pat if he ever hit a deer after we take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us. We'll be back with our outdoor communicators after the news. Thanks so much for joining in on WPR. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the Wisconsin Outdoors today with our outdoor communicators, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer, editor of and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Question or a comment about how our wildlife areas are managed or run, maybe an experience to share. Love to have you join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Pat, we didn't hear from you. I will say that I ran into a deer, or a deer ran into us as we were coming back from an unsuccessful deer hunt trip.
Well, I was kind of hoping you might call me for that particular question, but I'm now 68 years old. I've owned only three trucks since 1976. And so first thing I'd note, Larry, is that, you know, when you quote those, I'm guessing those numbers you have are from insurance company, some insurance company data. And my experience shows that those aren't always a full accounting of the number of accidents out there, because my first deer crash with my first truck, the truck was so old, I didn't bother telling the insurance company about it because I knew they just totaled it. My second one, I had to notify the insurance company. And my third one, I had to notify the insurance company. Both times they dumped me after I got those accidents. Meanwhile, my wife has never hit a deer, even though she drives at least as much as I do. And so she likes to point out that she's just a more careful driver than me. Now, this also brings up, I think, something you'll appreciate, is that in the time you've had the three of us on over the years, I don't think we've ever discussed the great conspiracy theory about insurance companies manipulating the DNR over deer accidents. And I'm just kind of surprised that topic has never come up, because it's the most pervasive wives' tale that's out there when it comes to deer hunting. And the insurance companies really don't care how many deer we hit, because I can tell you from my own personal experience that when you move to an area or live in an area with high deer crash numbers, the insurance companies jack your rates up. Mm-hmm. And I ran this idea past one of my daughters, my middle daughter, Ellie, who's an insurance actuary. And when I said that there's this conspiracy out there that these insurance companies are pushing the DNR to shoot more deer to reduce these deer crashes, she started laughing, because she said, of all the things that actuaries can calculate and extrapolate risk assessments from, that'd be one of the easiest things to predict. You know, so she was not convinced that there's any big insurance, you know, cabal going on out there.
Scott in Belleville has something for us that relates, I believe. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I just got a little story for you that pertains to your topic today. About 20 years ago, I took hunter safety class, and this girl walked in, younger girl walked in a little late, and she was crying, and she went up and whispered something to the hunter safety class instructor, and the teacher puts his finger up in the air, and he said, class, we have an important topic here, and he said, the most expensive way to harvest a deer is with a vehicle. And, you know, he couldn't be any more right on that either, and it's a good lesson for everybody.
Right. It is indeed. Scott, thanks a lot for calling. So run into one on your way to a hunter safety class. That's kind of a new one. Hunter classes reminds me of something else that I wanted to bring up, and that relates to the national, what's the name of the organization, the National Youth Bow Archery, National Youth Archery Program, which I don't know if you, Dean, I thought you guys did might have done a piece on it, because Wisconsin DNR kind of is helpful in that area.
Are you talking about National Archery in Schools Program?
Yes, I couldn't remember the name of the exact name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've run some stuff on that a number of times over the years. The DNR is involved, but there are also local coaches and instructors at each school, for each school that's involved. I don't know a lot about the program, other than, you know, there's a high level of participation. The kids enjoy it. It seems like a lot of fun, and they learn archery. And it's not necessarily aimed at getting kids into the field hunting with bows and arrows, but some of them do. But it's just, it's been going on, heck, I don't know, at least 20 years, maybe a little bit longer. It seems like as long as I've worked at Outdoor News, we've run something about the NASP program. So maybe Pat or Tim know a little bit more about it than I do.
Yeah.
I've watched at one of the local events that they had, and it really was interesting, the kids, how interested they were. But it also reminds me that there's a lot now. There's a lot of trap shooting, you know, trap shooting teams from the different high schools. And so this is really a great way for youngsters to learn bow hunting skills and shotgun skills, which I think is a great way to learn.
Yeah. Jamie in Algoma will give you a chance. Hi, Jamie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to share a tip I learned, I'm pretty sure, on your show years ago about how to avoid a deer collision in your car. The only caveat is you got to see them coming. I learned that if you tap staccato, like beep, 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 real short beeps with your horn, if you see them, they will turn around and run the other way. I have tried this many, many times. It's worked every single time. Instead of a really long horn blast, because for some reason that disorients them, confuses them, but those short little blasts, I've had one come ripping across a field at me full steam, and I thought, we're going to collide for sure. And I tried that, and it dug in and turned a U-turn and headed the other way.
Oh.
And I work as a courier, so I drive 170 miles a day for work and have had many occasions to use it, have passed that along to other careers, other people, and I've just found it to be a great technique, but you got to see them first.
You got to see them first. Jamie, that's a good idea. Good. I hope Pat Durkin was listening.
So maybe Pat,
yes, I was.
They're so old the horn doesn't work anymore.
Oh boy. Jamie, thanks. Well, that's a good tip. Beep, 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 like that, instead of the long slam on your horn.
You bet. I once talked to one of the DNR conservation wardens, and I had asked him the question about, you know, what do you do when you see a deer like that? And he had urged me to hit the horn. But that beep, 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 that sounds like a good way to do it.
Yeah. Lee in Deerfield, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was particularly taken by the fact that you said there's 15 to 20,000 deer killed on Wisconsin roads every year. What is the DNR doing about that? Or what solutions are people looking into? Like, you know, deer crossings, you know, you've seen the thing where the pathway goes over a highway, for example, like on a really busy place where lots of deer accidents happen. I'm just curious, are there any solutions other than, you know, anecdotal, like, you know, you got to be aware of deer. Well, we all know that, but that's pretty impossible when they come flying through your windshield. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's my comment.
Okay. Thanks for calling. Who wants to take a crack at that? I know.
I can.
Yeah, go ahead, Pat.
As far as these over-the-road bear, transition paths, or you want to call them that, I think they're more effective out west in the more open country, where they do a better job of basically figuring out where these deer like to cross these areas, especially on their migration routes for mule deer. Wisconsin, we have deer so commonly everywhere, from within our cities to rural areas, you name it, there's deer. So it's harder to you know, work something like that where you put a you know, barriers up and then funnel them over to an overpass. They do know from research in other states that underpasses do not work. Deer do not like going into confined areas, and they just go into those things and typically turn around, go back out, because they don't like having their vision cut off like that. So the when they can do an overpass, they do, but they are very expensive. And I really don't know that we could build enough overpasses in Wisconsin when we have so many potholes to fill and all other stuff that are taking highway budget dollars from us.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Richard in Mount Vernon believes that a lot of the collisions would be prevented if there was more roadside mowing to the fence lines. That would allow drivers to see deer in time to avoid hitting them.
Well, that's my excuse.
Okay. All right. Well, you can join in too. Still time, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. We talked last time about all of your thoughts on sandhill crane hunting, but I did want to report that there's a meeting of a legislative committee. Isn't there, Tim, to talk about this?
You're right. There was a legislative study committee, and they've met, I think, three times already. And today, in fact, they are meeting right now in the state capitol here in Madison. So they're looking at two things. One, they're looking at a possible bill that would help to pay farmers for putting some type of a chemical or something on that would discourage sandhill cranes from pulling up corn when it's just sprouting. But the other thing, they're looking at a hunting season. So they've got a suggested legislative proposal right now that would direct the Department of Natural Resources to authorize a sandhill crane hunting season. And so they're discussing that right now. And basically, if they agree to that, then they will make that recommendation to the legislature to come up with an actual bill in the new legislature starting in 2025. And basically, it is controversial. Sandhill cranes are hunted in other states, but people have pros and cons on ideas. I can just mention that from my standpoint, I don't think for Wisconsin it's a good idea. Anybody who's read a Sand County Almanac and Aldo Leopold, his marshland elegy, knows the importance of the sandhill cranes. And basically, it's my concern is it's going to divide the hunting public from the non-hunting public. And right now, we know that the DNR needs more funding for all of their programs. We need to get the non-hunters to pay to pay into the conservation fund to help all of these things. So rather than split the two organizations, you know, hunters and non-hunters, we need to get people together. And also, the crop damage law, I think, is flawed in Wisconsin because it requires, in order to pay a farmer for crop damage, the species has to be hunted. Well, that's wildlife belong to all of us, and all of us should be paying for the crop damage. So I'd like to see him come up with a bill that basically would take the payments for crop damage out of the GPR, the regular tax money, because all of us have an interest in wildlife. So, and different states have different regulations. Out west, they do hunt sandhill cranes. I mean, they hunt prairie chickens. We don't have prairie chickens in Wisconsin. So each state is individual. And I think it's a social issue here in Wisconsin. And so it'll be very interesting. I am surprised that there have been a lot of hunters who have come out in support of it through the Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. But I just think it's going to split the non-hunters from the hunters.
We've got Austin and Lafarge back to deer collisions, I think. Austin, your turn. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to share a tip that someone gave me years ago. And when you see a deer that's gone down the other side of the ditch, pay attention because they might have a few friends following up the other side. And I think that's often where folks think they're in the clear, and then all of a sudden there's three more. And I also had a question regarding if there's ever been any research into the rise in CWD and the increase in deer collisions in the state, because I would say that sometimes I see dumber deer and smarter deer that seem to look both ways and some that don't. So
yeah. I don't think there's been any research on that, or at least not that I have heard. Pat, anything?
Yeah. Actually, I haven't seen the more recent results on this study the DNR was doing on in Iowa County on CWD and its impact on deer. But one thing they found was that, you know, deer carrying CWD are was like 60% more likely to be dead within the year of that detection. And one of the things they speculate on and saw some numbers on, these deer tend to be killed on the highway at a higher rate than a healthy deer. And so, you know, it's conceivable that it's, I mean, it just makes sense that a deer suffering from a fatal disease would have its, you know, perceptions and sensory capabilities being in decline too, and they might be just make themselves more susceptible, hanging around roads more often, whatever it might be, and getting picked off that way.
Yeah, well, that makes sense to me as well. We have I've got a bunch of other things I could bring up. One is the management units. The Wisconsin DNR has proposed changes to the state's deer management units. The state agency reviews the unit boundaries, I guess, every few years. What could changes in the boundaries mean for hunting?
Larry, I could jump in on that one.
Yeah, go ahead, Dean.
The main reason I want to jump in right away is I see that we're going to be running out of time real soon, and I just want to make sure people are aware that there are meetings coming up on the DNR's proposal to change the deer units in two areas of the state. There's a virtual meeting, and they can go on the DNR website to find this, but there's a virtual meeting on November 18th on a Monday from 5. These are all 5 to 7 p.m. There's a virtual meeting Monday, November 18th. There's one in Cable on Tuesday, November 19th, one in Adams on Wednesday, November 20th. And I know there's also one in Woodruff, but I am not finding the Woodruff meeting date on my phone.
I think it's tomorrow.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it's tomorrow.
Okay. All right. So anyway, those meetings are coming up, and if anybody has an interest in what the DNR has come up with, the map is posted on the DNR's website. This had all started out as an effort to try to get the DNR to go back to the original numbered units that we had prior to James Kroll's Deer Trustee report and the unit switch that began in 2014 where it went to the counties. There's been a lot of people pulling at this piece of paper going through the process, and it's not where we were hoping it would go, but they do have a plan out there. And people should take a look at the DNR website, look at the map, try to understand a little bit, and then learn more or comment at the meetings.
I'm glad you had that information in hand, Dean. Mike in Cross Plains has a question, I think. Mike, hello.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so my son and my son-in-law and daughter live out between Jefferson and Johnson Creek, and they're seeing more and more albino deer on their property. Currently, you know, you can't shoot an albino deer, but my son-in-law's argument is if you don't shoot them, the white ones, all you're doing is allowing them to pass on that genetic trait of the albinoism. And I know it's kind of a controversy. Some people just think they're the coolest critter out there, but is there any discussion of the DNR allowing the harvesting of white or albino deer? I know you can shoot piebald deer, but they have to have, you know, significant brown spots on them.
Yeah. Tim, are you aware of any?
No, I'm not aware of any effort to open up a season on white deer. I know they're very special, like he says, and especially up around Boulder Junction, there's quite a few of them up there that people really treasure, but I'm not aware of that.
I don't think there's been any discussion recently about it. Dean, I want to go, you know, we're starting to run out of time here, but there was a terrible poaching case. We talked about it a little bit when Scott Craven was on a week ago, but any updates on this outrageous deer poaching case in Washington County?
Well, yeah, there are. We have an update in the current issue Wisconsin Outdoor News in print and on our website. The mother, the adult female who's involved in the case, has had her preliminary hearing. Not a whole lot happened there, but that'll continue moving through. She was charged with 3 misdemeanors, one of them being
contributing to the delinquency of minors. I can't remember the other two. Right? Oh, one was obstruction of a law enforcement officer. If she were to receive full penalties, it'd be quite a staggering amount of money, even though they're misdemeanors. The three teens we can't really talk about yet about what their charges are going to be, and they're going to be all processed in Fond du Lac County Court. Unless the only way we'd get into that is if they're waived into adult court, then we can get access to their criminal complaints. I've been talking to folks from the Campbellsport area quite a bit this last week, and there are some highly, well, I can't say that. Let me see. I don't want to swear on the radio. Highly ticked off individuals in the Campbellsport area who just can't believe that this was happening. You know, I'll be talking to some of those folks, and we'll have an article coming up in the future issue on thoughts from folks in the Campbellsport area about what happened out there. But yeah, and it's not just deer. I mean, there was some other awful stuff. There were videos taken and posted and by these kids, but what they did, what I've heard, and allegedly they captured a possum in a trap, let it loose, shot it with a flare gun, took videos of it running away on fire. Oh. I mean, you know what? There's a lot of bad stuff that, you know, happened here. And, the community is just, upset, totally upset.
Well, you would hope that there will be some quick and efficient justice done in those cases, for sure. Well, I tell
well,
you,
I know these,
yeah, go ahead, Dean.
Well, I know a lot of these folks have been, the word I'm getting is that a lot of citizens in the Campbellsport area and the surrounding three counties are writing letters to the judges, district attorneys, of how they feel this ought to be handled. They really want to see something happen here.
And one final thing, the DNR has cut back on the number of CWD kiosks present around the state. I'm wondering, was it just a dollars issue?
Most likely.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. Well, Dean, Pat, Tim, I want to thank you, all three of you, for being with us again. Another great discussion, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah. Thank you, Larry.
You bet. Thanks, Larry. Yep, appreciate it.
Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, and president of Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. They've been doing this for a long time with us, and it's always fun and interesting for me to, and I hope for you as well, to have them back. I'm judging from the comments, I'm sure they are. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the 2025 Wisconsin Phenology Calendar. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. The Birds and Turn, Turn, Turn. There we go. Great way to start the show as we take a look at the 2025 Wisconsin Phenology calendar with our guest back with us once again, Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW, current Senior Fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and talking with us about the phenology calendar and maybe a little about climate. Certainly it turns up in the calendar. I was looking a bit through it, and there's some things that we need to talk about relating to it. And I want to hear from you. Do you pay attention to the birds or the other wildlife and track their behavior from season to season? Like me, do you have that Wisconsin Phenology calendar nearby? I keep it right nearby, in fact, within a few feet of myself most days. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk info@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Stan Temple, welcome back. Good to have you
with us. It's good to be back, Larry. I think this is probably the 12th or 13th time we've done this annual update on what's happening in the phenology world.
It's always fun. It's always interesting. And, you know, you're a fellow, senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. The foundation's had a busy year.
It has been a very busy year. Lots of events. It was the 75th anniversary of the publication of a Sand County Almanac, Aldo Leopold's masterwork. It's 100 years since Aldo Leopold played the lead role in designating the first wilderness area on public lands in the U.S. It's the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico. And, boy, we've had some big events. Last weekend was the Great Midwest Crane Fest that we co-host with the International Crane Foundation. I think we had over 1,200 people come to take in the sight of 10,000 sandhill cranes staging on the Wisconsin River.
It's a fantastic organization, foundation, and it's great to know that things are going so well. And, you know, kind of, was this the impetus of the phenology calendar, Aldo Leopold's work in this area?
It certainly was. Aldo Leopold, from childhood, literally till the day he died in 1948, kept daily observations of the things that were happening in nature. And anyone who has read a Sand County Almanac knows that the first half of the book features essays month by month documenting the sort of iconic events that were happening here in south-central Wisconsin. So Aldo Leopold in the pantheon of phenology is very high-ranking.
Well, phenology, for, you know, there may be people not familiar with it, so remind us what phenology is.
That's quite simply, it's the study of the timing of seasonal events, keeping track of when key events in the lives of animals and plants or in the physical world happen each year. And people, of course, have been doing this probably ever since we became humans. It's important to keep track of how the seasons are changing, but we've become much more sophisticated in recent years. There are a lot of citizen science programs that allow naturalist observers to upload their observations so that scientists can try to make sense out of how the lives of plants and animals are shifting in response to climate change.
Yeah, and you know, I think it took a long time for phenology to become accepted as a legitimate science.
I think that's absolutely true. Aldo Leopold published a paper back in the 1947 on phenology, and boy, it was hardly cited at all, even though it was a major paper. It wasn't until 30-some years later when we started to worry about climate change that we suddenly realized that Aldo Leopold had left us this important historical marker of how plants and animals were arranging their annual cycles back in the 1930s and 1940s. And it became a real benchmark. Aldo Leopold's daughter, Nina Leopold Bradley, published a paper in the 1990s, one of the first, actually, to use historical information to document how plants and animals are adapting to climate change.
Amazing. And every year, the foundation puts out a Wisconsin phenology calendar. Of course, you make a pretty big contribution to that calendar.
Yeah, the calendar every year, I mean, it is a calendar. So what we've done on the calendar part is to alert you to when you can reasonably expect to see certain events. And we've got several hundred of those events chronicled on the calendar. But we go a little bit further than that. We also, every year, have a topic that we explore in some depth. And this year, the topic that we're exploring, for next year, for 2025, we're exploring the concept of a thermal niche, that plants and animals have a range of temperatures in which they can thrive. And when the climate changes, either getting too hot or too cold, somehow plants and animals have to adapt to that. So what we discuss in the calendar is how do all these creatures manage to shift their thermal niches when the environment changes? And they do it in three basic ways. One, obviously, is front and center in the phenology calendar, and that is that they can shift when certain key events like breeding happen during the year so that it occurs in the right temperature range. Another way they could do it is by making some subtle shifts in where they live. Oh, an animal might, you know, move to the north side of a hill rather than the south side if things are getting too warm in the south. And finally, the third way that they could adjust to a changing climate is to just move a great distance, covering a lot of ground, to move to places either at higher latitudes, move northward, or move to higher elevations where the temperatures are cooler. And it does go both ways. You know, some plants and animals are actually not looking necessarily for getting away from the heat, but are taking advantage of our warming climate. So here in Wisconsin, for example, we have a lot of plants and animals that used to be found south of Wisconsin that are now turning up in our state as we become warmer and warmer and more like where they live to the south.
That's one of the interesting things about the calendar, in addition to the dates, this beautiful photography that's in the book. The sidebars are always, in some ways, the most interesting parts for me. And the North Carolina wren, just for what you were talking about in your new calendar, you talk about the North Carolina wren with, by the way, a beautiful photo of it. But
yeah, the Carolina wren, which is, you know, the featured species for the month of November 2025. And as their name implies, Carolina wrens, you know, are typical, more typical of southern states. They've now, of course, moved into southern Wisconsin. And in the sidebar, where we talk about their movement northward, we also point out that if the climate continues warming as it has for the last 50 years, by 2050, they're going to be up in Wausau. So they are steadily moving, you know, northward as we get warmer. And, you know, just this week, I said, we had the Crane Fest.
Yeah.
Cranes, of course, are big birds. They can tolerate cold temperatures. And back in Aldo's day, cranes would have been leaving Wisconsin on migration late October, early November. Last year, the cranes didn't leave until early January, and they were back in early February. So the warming, the shorter winters, you know, winter coming later and spring coming earlier has allowed them to spend a lot more time in Wisconsin than they used to.
Yeah. And you, because of Aldo Leopold's notations through the course of the year and then the observations through the Wisconsin Phenology Calendar since then, that particular area has warmed up.
It has, of course. I think we're all sort of finally getting the message that, you know, things are really changing with the climate in Wisconsin. And, you know, we've been warming a little over half a degree Fahrenheit every year. And most dramatic warming is actually happening in the winter. So things are changing that have big impacts on the lives of plants and animals. This is not some, you know, minor change. These are things that really require major adaptations for these animals and plants to thrive.
Yeah, I was thinking it was like a plus 5 degrees over a relatively short period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, when you consider especially that some plants and animals have really narrow thermal niches, this range in which they're comfortable. And other animals, of course, have really wide temperature tolerance. We use the example of the common carp. Mm-hmm. A common carp can live in waters in a wide range of temperatures, anyway from 40 degrees up to 90 degrees, tepid bathwater. But if you look at a lake trout can only live in very narrow range of temperature from 45 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you're a lake trout, and the lake that you're in is warming, you're going to have to do some shifting to stay within that narrow range of temperatures in which you can thrive.
Our guest today, Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, with us today to talk a little about the Aldo Leopold Foundation, but to highlight the coming, the 2025 Wisconsin Phenology Calendar. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking Phenology, the 2025 Wisconsin Phenology Calendar with our guest today, Stan Temple, who is a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation and really does yeoman work in getting this calendar put together every year, among other things that he does. Join in. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Mike and Marinette called, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know about the status of the of Mauritius, kestrels in Wisconsin. Mauritius?
Okay, well, he's got my name attached correctly, but not the right geography. The Mauritius kestrel is found on the island of Mauritius out in the middle of the Indian Ocean, which is more or less infamous in conservation circles as the former home of the dodo bird. But back in the early 1970s, I launched a conservation program for the Mauritius kestrel, which at the time was the most endangered bird in the world. There are only 7 of them left. And the program over the decades has succeeded, so there are now over 700 of them. One of the many species that my students and I have worked on that fortunately have recovered thanks to our work.
He thinks there has been an increase in egrets and wonders if that's related to frog populations, perhaps.
Actually, the egrets are a good example of another southern species, sort of like Carolina wrens, that have been, they've always visited Wisconsin briefly, especially during the late summer when birds that have bred in the southern states kind of wander north. But now, of course, they're much more comfortable being in Wisconsin for much longer periods of time and are fairly regularly seen birds around the state.
The calendar itself, the photography, I want to go back to the photography a bit because it's one of the things that I enjoy having that kind of hung up. The photography is just outstanding. Describe some of that.
Yeah, nature photographers of Wisconsin, have discovered our phenology calendar as one of the premier places to display their skill at photography, and it is really remarkable the images that they get. Not only that they can capture, especially animals doing amazing things, but that the images themselves are just remarkably crisp and just beautiful to look at. So, yeah, and clearly, a lot of people take nature photography as a hobby and can produce these amazing images, and it's almost a competition, really, now for people to get a spot on the calendar. Whether their photograph gets picked largely depends on the plants and animals that we decide to focus on for the given year, but we have yet to put out a call for a good photo of a plant and animal that somebody didn't come up with the image we were after.
Oh, amazing. Todd has a cabin in the Shawangunk National Forest, which an area that I love to spend time in. Todd, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking the call. I've been a supporter of the foundation and get the calendar every year and love it. But as I was listening to the program, I heard Kimberly Clark mentioned as a sponsor. And it got me to wonder, what are the large forest, I should say wood and paper manufacturers, those that use so much of the forest product, what are they doing to address the changes that we see in climate, being that our forests are integral to maintaining our climate?
Well, it's a good question, and you can be sure they are concerned about it because some of the more important species, either for timber or for paper products, are shifting their range. And for plants, shifting your range takes time. Obviously, trees can't get up and move, so they have to depend on each year more and more of their seeds germinating in increasingly favorable places. But the climate is changing so rapidly that a lot of our forests in northern Wisconsin, up where you live, are essentially on the way out, in that the dominant species of plants, trees that live there, are shifting their range northward. The same is true of the wildlife that occurs there. You know, we think of the North Woods as being typical of certain types of wildlife, and some of those species are gradually shifting out of Wisconsin. Sort of an iconic species for the North Woods, like a ruffed grouse, are gradually shifting northward.
Todd, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And I should have done this earlier, but a caller phoned in and wants to order the calendar. And there's a number that wonders, hey, how can I call and order the calendar?
Probably the easiest way is to go to the Aldo Leopold Foundation website, which is simply aldoleopold.org. And in our bookstore, you can order the calendar, and it'll be on its way to you within a day. $16.95 this year, a real bargain.
It is indeed. Thanks so much for that question. Appreciate it. Steve in Osceola called to say that oak trees that hold their leaves through winter are wondering if are they a warmer weather species? Is that true? That
well, if you can come up with the definitive answer of why certain oak trees hang on to their lower leaves over the winter, you know, you got yourself a publication. But the prevailing idea is that oaks are very fire dependent, and by keeping the leaves on the tree over the winter, they can fall in the spring and support spring fire, whereas the leaves that fell the previous fall might be too damp. So there could be a possible explanation that this is actually in the tree's best interest to keep at least some of its leaves on through the winter and let them drop in the spring when they can fuel fire.
Well, it's interesting. I interviewed an author who had written about, among other things, light, and how light can have an impact on everything, and including trees. In the UK, there was some research done on city trees, comparing the light, the amount of light they get has actually changed how the trees, I think it's by about a week and a half, how they've kind of shifted their patterns with leaves and so forth.
Yeah, we've been talking mostly about how temperature affects the lives of plants and animals, but there is also photoperiod, day length. And many plants and animals time their seasonal events pretty precisely to how day length changes throughout the year. And if we disrupt that, obviously, with artificial illumination in town, there is clearly evidence that we can start shifting the annual cycles of plants. And, of course, you know, lights and wildlife often have fatal consequences. So there's major conservation efforts now in most of our big cities, including Madison, to try to get tall glass buildings to turn off their lights at night during bird migration so that we're not killing millions and millions of songbirds as they're migrating fall and spring.
Diane in Iron County has a question for you about the calendar. Let's go there. Hi, Diane.
Hi. So, look, I bought the calendar a while ago, and then I would look at it, and I'd be like, oh, okay. But then I'd have to look 2 weeks in the future to see what, you know, or in the past to see what's really happening by me.
Yeah.
Is there some way that people could put their longitude in? You know, I buy the calendar, and then I go and I put my longitude in, and then I can print one that where the dates shift.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, since we are featuring data from Aldo Leopold here in South Central Wisconsin, our calendar is most accurate for South Central Wisconsin. And every year on the calendar, we do include a little sidebar about Hopkins' Law. Hopkins was an American entomologist who, back in the 19th century, figured out that the dates on which things happened across the country actually were sort of orderly. And here in Wisconsin, for example, from the Illinois border all the way up to Lake Superior, there's about a 22-day difference in when things are likely to happen. And similarly, from east to west, there's about a 10-day difference between western Wisconsin and eastern Wisconsin. So yes, if you look at the dates that we are presenting for South Central Wisconsin, you may have to do some calculations to figure out how much later, well, since you're far north of us, how much later you could expect these events. But at least we've given you fair warning that it's coming.
There you go, Diane. John in Appleton, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry and guests. Thank you for both of all. Thank you for all you do. So I'm wondering, I'm a cross-country skier, and the last couple of years, it's been pretty slim pickings up here for doing that sport outdoors.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the guest has any thoughts, contrary to what the Farmer's Almanac says about how much snow we'll get this year. And thank you. Yeah. Thank you for all you do.
Yeah, we don't do weather forecasting. But the consequence of less snow is pretty serious for some plants and animals. And in fact, the January feature animal for next year is the American marten. And American martens in the winter do a lot of their hunting under the snow for rodents. And with less snow cover, they have less opportunity to do their hunting underneath the snow, where the temperatures are very much moderated, and are forced to do their hunting above the snow, where temperatures are more extreme. So the American marten is a species that's actually having trouble in northern Wisconsin for a number of reasons, but also because the winters are becoming milder. And like many of the species we've already mentioned, you know, martens are almost certainly going to be shifting their range northward.
Yeah, and fewer of them, unfortunately. John, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Well, I see we're starting to run out of... Boy, this flew by.
Yeah.
So once again, let's go over, how do we get copies of the calendar?
Well, Larry, you always put the contact information up on your social media and website, but the easiest way for people to get their calendar is to go to aldoleopold.org, which is the website for the Leopold Foundation. Click on our bookstore. You can order your calendars for $16.95 each, and they'll be in the mail to you the next day.
It's amazing how fast that operation works anymore these days.
And we know a lot of people like to buy these as Christmas gifts. It's coming up, so people want to get them quickly.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Stan, to have you with us. I appreciate your time, not only your time just coming by, but all the time you've spent on this calendar and the other things you do. So thank you so much.
And see you next year.
You'll be back, and we will do this all over again. Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, currently Senior Fellow as well with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Great to have him with us. And I want to thank you for listening in today. This and all the other shows that we do are a team effort. Our producers, we have Joel Patnaud today, Clara Neipert, technical directors Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And of course, I'm Larry Mueller, and I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope you will please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. And the time to every girl.
summertime.